So you have 3-4 phases. So phase one, safety, phase two, efficacy, phase three, pivotal trial. Then you have post-marketing. Clinical trials, this is the longest and most expensive part of drug development. It can take, on average, more than 10 years and more than $3 billion to run clinical trials.
Welcome to the AWS Health Innovation Podcast, where you can learn from entrepreneurs and investors who are driving progress in healthcare and life science around the globe. Welcome back. We live at a golden age of innovation in drug development, but new medicines take far too long to get into the clinic due to our inefficient and costly clinical trial infrastructure. Phase 5 leverages cutting-edge technologies like reinforcement and causal machine learning to advance adaptive trial design and execution. Their novel approach aims to improve trial success rates while maximizing efficiency, but what's truly remarkable is their ability to detect hidden signals in data and extract actionable insights when analyzing clinical trial results. I'm Alex Merwin from AWS, and joining us today is Raviv Kreluk, CEO and co-founder of Phase 5, who will share insights into their groundbreaking approach to optimizing clinical trials. Our host for this episode is Guy Spiegelman, the EMEA lead for healthcare and life sciences startups at Amazon Web Services. This is a great one. Here we go.
Hello and welcome to the AWS Innovation Podcast. I'm very pleased today to welcome Raviv Kreluk, who is the CEO and co-founder of Phase 5 Clinical Trials. Raviv, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Guy. It's a pleasure to be here.
How are you doing?
I'm good.
Busy days. What? You're a startup founder. Why? What does that mean, busy? What does your day look like? When do you get up in the morning? When do you go to bed?
Going to the beach, drinking a lot of cocktails.
A beer, mojitos. I'm sure that's what you're doing.
No, not really. No, so A lot of travels. Yeah, no, actually, it's exciting times. I think I'm lucky to be in the field and trying to bring innovation to that space. I feel privileged. Busy is good.
But let's take a step back and let's, first of all, introduce yourself. Raviv, who are you? How did you start this business? Why did you start this business? And tell us what the business is. What are you trying to do?
Sure. So briefly about myself. So I'm an engineer by training. I have bachelor's and master's in engineering. I have a PhD in computation and neuroscience. Actually, that was the first time that I've learned that there's a difference between engineering and biology. You can do the same thing over and over again, but the results are different.
In biology.
Not the case in biology. Yeah, exactly. I was doing my PhD wasn't computation and neuroscience, but I did there was experimental science. It was a good lesson about the differences between biology and engineering. Nevertheless, I spent most of my professional career in tech industries, defense industries. I was leading multidisciplinary engineering teams. Switched to biotech. I've been in a fast-growing startup, a team and I, single-cell multi-omics, machine learning. I was SVP of analytics and operations there. I think that I felt two things. So the first one is that I've encountered that no matter how cool your biology is and how promising your biology is, if you're not going to design, conduct, and analyze clinical trials at the top level, your drug is not going to work. And the second thing is that Elad and my co-founder, know each other for many years. When I decided to found the company, it was clear to me that it's going to be with him. So we spent a long time ideating. At first, it was the opportunistic, but then at some point, we are geeks. So we started to create metrics and criteria for how we are going to choose.
I want to stop you there. I want to actually dive deep onto this, on the founder's story, because I think that's super fascinating. And we will talk more about that because I've done a few of these podcasts and that bit I haven't dove into. So I think that'll be really interesting for the listeners. Before that, let's just do a basic introduction to Phase 5, because I think we missed that. And I want to just make sure the listeners really understand who you are, what you're doing, what's the problem space, what's your solution?
You are completely right. Clinical trials, this is the longest and most expensive part of drug development. It can take on average more than 10 years and more than $3 billion to run clinical trials.
Per clinical trial?
Per the full, like there are phases. So from preclinical, after you have already a leading molecule, up to approval. So you have 3-4 phases. So phase one, safety, phase two, efficacy, phase three, pivotal trial, and then you have post-marketing. So this process can take more than 10 years and more than $3 billion. Actually, the numbers are changing all the time on average because failure rates are very high, right? So from a molecule that started the clinical development, clinical trial phase, you have less than 10% to be successful. So a lot of failures. So this is a problem. And essentially,
just to double click on that. So what you're saying, I know this, but I think it's a very thing that we really need to understand as a society, yeah, not just as an industry, that this $3 billion 10-year process has a 90% failure rate.
Exactly. And the implications are enormous, right? At the end of the day, the fact that drugs are so expensive. So if you, unfortunately, an oncology patient today, it's going to be super expensive to get immunotherapy, the novel types of drugs in oncology. Similarly, actually, obesity are, yeah, expensive and so on and so forth. And the reason is not because pharma industry are unfair. It's because it's so expensive to develop drugs. They need to, to have return over investment. Exactly. Yeah. And so anyways, that's the challenge. And it's not only efficiency and effectiveness. Millions of patients are participating in clinical trials every year, and so many of them are getting ineffective drugs. It's not ethical. If you have a friend who is participating in a clinical trial, he or she has very high likelihood to get ineffective and maybe risky drug. So we want to change that. We want to make clinical trials more optimal, more ethical, more efficient, more effective. That's the problem. And
Yeah, I'm just summarizing it. Two big problems, basically, the time and money, but also the patient experience through a clinical trial, which is they're getting sometimes drugs that are not effective and even harmful. And so that raises serious ethical questions. And that's the problem space you landed at. We'll get to how you landed at that in a second. What's your solution? What are you doing?
So first of all, we are harnessing technologies that we are very well familiar. We are not experts in molecular biology. However, the team that we established are experts in software, machine learning, optimization. And then we took a look on other tech domains. A clinical trial or clinical trials in general essentially are experiments. And in the past decade, we've seen revolution in how experiments are being designed and conducted in other tech domains. So if you think about transportation, marketing, gaming, all these fields went through revolution in the design and execution of experiments. And then we said, okay, let's try to leverage and harness technologies from these domains while carefully understanding that clinical trials are unique. We are talking about patients, there are regulators, and there are unique characteristics for the clinical trials. And basically what we did, we built two platforms. The first platform is a platform for the design and execution of adaptive dynamic clinical trials. Those trials, in contrary to fixed trials, are leveraging the accumulating data during the trial. So you have data that is accumulated. In many trials, we are waiting till the end in order to know whether the drug is working or not. Mm-hmm. And we are wasting a lot of time, patience, and resources just to realize that some of the doses weren't effective. Some of the patients weren't responsive and so on and so forth. So instead of waiting till the end, let's look at the data while it's accumulating and make decisions during the trial. This opens the opportunity to be much more effective, much more efficient. However,
isn't there a risk though that like you're changing parameters in the middle? Doesn't that affect the validity of the trial in some way?
Yeah, that's a very good point. So in 2019, the FDA published the guidance of how to design and conduct adaptive trials. The basic idea is that you are submitting the protocol in advance as an adaptive protocol. So you are approving in front of the regulator what are going to be all the modifications and adaptations that you are going to conduct you predefine them. And then once the data is accumulating, you're operating based on what you already defined. So you're running million scenarios before the trial. And then when the trial is progressing, you're navigating based on the predefined scenarios. It could be scenario number 7,000 or 100,000, but it was already predefined. And in that sense, you are maintaining the validity. And obviously, there are much more ways to keep statistical guarantees, type 1 error, and other important criteria in clinical trials. But despite the many benefits, efficiency, effectiveness, ethical, there are a lot of challenges in conducting these type of trials. First and foremost, they are less intuitive. So statistics is not intuitive to non-statistician in general, but especially if we are talking about things that are changing. This is Bayesian statistics. It's much more complex and not intuitive. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And then if you think about the persona in the pharma industry, they are super intelligent, but for good reason, they are conservative. They don't want to take risks, and especially if they don't understand what's going on under the hood. And if adaptive trials are more complex, they would hesitate to use them. So this is one challenge. The second challenge is those type of trials are more complex. From operational standpoint, things are changing. You need to change allocation ratio. You need to change the supply of drugs and so on and so forth. And there are a few other challenges. Basically, what we did is to build a software platform harnessing machine learning and AI that on one hand reaped the benefit, but on the other hand, help the sponsors and CROs to overcome the challenges. The intuitiveness, operational challenges, execution, running the scenarios, and so on and so forth. So this is one platform that we've built. While building the platform, we've learned that actually there is another challenge, analyzing the data. And it might sound odd, but still most of clinical trials are being analyzed using conventional methods. A conventional bias statistics is very powerful whenever the biology is linear or simple. But today, biology is becoming more and more complex. We are trying to develop drugs that are personalized, and there is the heterogeneity response. Different patients, you and I, are responding differently to drugs. Yep. And if you want to analyze this and detect it, and you have many endpoints, so today in the generative, and oncology and immunology, the endpoints are becoming more and more complex. How do we know if someone is responding? So how do we know what is the disease manifestation? Sounds easy, but appearing to be very complex questions with complex answers that are affecting the way we are designing and analyzing clinical trials. We harness tools from the world of causal machine learning, where the intersection between causal inference and machine learning. This is allowing us to detect causality, not only correlation between parameters, but also what's driving what. And this is extremely important if we want to know why you are responding better to one drug and I'm responding better to another. And this is
essentially
the basis.
So essentially the causality bit, which is really important, and that before was unattainable. What are you doing new that makes that now attainable? Because I can imagine that's extremely attractive for the pharma companies to understand that, like mechanism of action, understanding what's going on is so critical, and often we don't understand it.
So causal inference is out there for many years, and machine learning is out there for many years. But combining the two, the causal machine learning aspect, is quite new. So there were breakthroughs actually in econometrics and in other domains, Nobel Prizes, that really brought into the front the synergy between machine learning and causal inference, having on one end the power of using the data and running many scenarios, but on the other end, keeping statistical guarantees and then teasing out the causality. And this is quite new, and we are bringing tools from the past few years and tailoring them towards the unique space of clinical trials. We just submitted a few patents. Yeah, submitted a few patents on exactly that, and we are about to release a few scientific papers that are really pushing the boundaries of what we can do with causal machine learning in clinical trial analysis.
I understand that you have IP and patent issues. Is there anything you can share from results of work you've already done on this and how it's making an impact?
Maybe I'll share three quick examples and I'll try to tweak. So one recent example from ALS. So ALS, it's a devastating disease. I know someone a few years ago, super athlete. Now, if you see him, it's devastating. This is the reason, and we can talk about this is the reason why I'm here. I really want to help patients across the globe. While it's in there, it's really clear that the transition.
Maybe just a quick overview of what ALS is in a couple of, for the listeners. I know what it is, but if you want to.
So it's a degeneration of the nervous system, and then effectively you see effect on the muscular system, and people have issues with the respiratory system, breathing, and
essentially, so anyway, from diagnosis, there's quite a rapid deterioration. Like we're talking months and years, but not that many years.
Exactly. And recently we partnered with a sponsor who got a readout of a phase 2 trial. The results were quite good. It seems that the drug is working, but one of the challenges is that a lot of trials are succeeding in phase 2 and then eventually failed in phase 3. And there are various reasons for that. I'll skip the reasons, but optimizing the transition between phase 2 to phase 3 is essential. And this is exactly what we did. We harnessed causal machine learning and actually detected that quite substantial subgroup, 70-80% of the patients are responding 2x more than others. And this is increasing dramatically the probability of this trial to work in the next trial. So this is one example of how you can harness the causal machine learning, detect subgroups of patients.
But let me just, so that 70-80%, that's a large group. It's not like 20%. And does that then mean that there are parameters with the other 20 to 30, which meant that this drug is not going to be appropriate for them?
So less appropriate. And actually, the association between the two groups made clinical sense. And this is important in the way we are building the causal machine learning models. We want them to be interpretable. So it was fast progressors versus slow progressors. So the drug worked more on fast progressors, those that the disease is progressing faster. And this is extremely beneficial, right? You actually want it to be more effective on fast progressors. So it made clinical sense. So this is one example. Another example that they want to give is actually from our other platform, the platform for the adaptive design and execution. One of the challenges in adaptive trials is that you have a competition between the endpoint. It takes time to the measurement to arrive. So let's take lupus patient as an example. You are measuring flares, right? So it's not immediate. It can take tens of weeks before you have the endpoint. It's a composite endpoint. And then on the other end, you're recruiting patients. If you want to make adaptations, you have to have the endpoint fast enough compared to the recruitment. And in some cases, it's not exactly that. So what you want to build is a surrogate endpoint, something that is fast enough, and it's a good proxy of what's going to be the endpoint. So for that, we harness machine learning, and we are developing surrogate endpoints that are predicting very well what's going to be the endpoint. Mm-hmm. And then we can make the adaptations in the interim analysis based on the surrogate, but still the drug is going to be approved and the decision at the end are going to be made by the primary endpoint. So it's a win situation. And we just presented in Vienna a week and a half ago very promising results of how you can harness surrogate endpoints, machine learning inspired in adaptive trials in order to do more adaptive trials. So this is a second example. And last but not least.
Wait, question about that. Who in your target customer audience of pharma, who would be excited by that last point, surrogate endpoints? Who's getting excited when you meet?
So first of all, the clinicians, clinical lead, clin dev, for them, being able to measure the biological aspect early on is extremely important. But also the operational teams, the biostat, it's really a burden that endpoints are so long.
So essentially, people are in the dark for a long time, and what you're doing is you're letting them, like in a submarine, go up, have a look. Oh, we're in the right direction, and come back down. Let's keep
going.
Let's make a small move this way to get to that same endpoint. Great. Okay.
Anyway,
you had a third point, and then I'll take it somewhere else.
So the third one is actually from oncology. One of the challenges in oncology, especially in phase 2, is that you have a lot of phase 2 trials with single arm. So you don't compare yourself to the standard of care that you are going to encounter in phase 3. And in oncology, we are talking about biomarker stratified patients, and the mechanism of action are actually quite similar across competitors. So it's not a surprise that your drug is working very well in phase two. And then when you're going to arrive to phase three, the competitor's drug is going to work similarly well on the biomarker stratified patient. But you are surprised and then failing in phase three. So if someone can bring you the competitor's data in phase two in a virtual setting in the biomarker stratified patient and let you know if your drug is actually better or not before you are going to phase three, this is a major benefit. And that's exactly what we developed together with a partner from Germany. So actually the largest oncology chain in Germany, extremely high quality company that collected the oncology longitudinal data with biomarkers for over 30 years. We are collaborating and bringing joint solution for pharma companies. We call it virtual phase three, for actually taking into account what you are going to meet in phase three already at the end of phase two. This is a third example.
Fantastic. Those are great examples. I want to go back to the ideation process. Two founders, you've got passion, you've got ability. How did that look? Did you just know you wanted to build something together?
So I think what was clear for us, and obviously gradually it became clearer, is that A, we want to build something together. B, that we wanted to be big, have big dreams. And three, actually, is the most important. We wanted to do something positive in the world. And this has actually helped us a lot because it's excluding, and obviously it's subjective, right? For someone, dynamic transportation is extremely positive, and for someone else, whatever, financial aspects are extremely important, climate, whatever. Yeah. So for us, it was mainly healthcare and climate. So we were ideating only around climate and healthcare. And it was opportunistic. So we are a big fans of doing and then reiterating and learning. So you have a theory, but you are learning much more from
the lean startup kind of thing, right?
Exactly. So we just met every week, and Elad, my co-founder, came for the second meeting with an article that he read about, actually, it's not a nice topic, about youth suicide. It's rising issue and we spent, actually it was opportunistic, but we spent quite some time on that. We felt that we had good ideas about technology. We obviously felt that this is an extremely important topic, but eventually after I think a few months, we realized that actually we couldn't come up with the right business model. And then we said, okay, let's define the criteria of how we are going to make the decision of what is the space of what we want to build.
So you actually developed methodology.
Exactly.
To guide your ideation process. That's really interesting.
Okay, exactly. Cool. So there were a few parameters, and I think we were inspired by projects that we did together back then. So we are liking to create criteria and then to rank them and to come up with an optimal solution that is both objective and subjective, right? You have numbers, but you have eventually gut feeling, right? What do we want to do? So one of the parameters is, what are we excited about? We want to wake up every day and to be excited about doing this. So this is a parameter, right? Subjective one. Another parameter was a major impact on society. We wanted to do something positive, and that if we are going to be successful, obviously, chances are low, because if you really want to do something big, this is statistics, right? Most likely that you are going to fail. That's fine. We are taking risks. But if we are going to be successful, we want it to be something that is going to change the world for the better. The third parameter, and again, it's not in any order. The third parameter was something that we felt that our skill sets are bringing something unique. So we wouldn't build something in hardware. We are not experts in hardware. We wouldn't build something that requires cyber. We are not experts in cyber. But software, statistics, machine learning, optimization, experimentation, those are things that we spent separately and together a lot of time, and we felt expert, at least to some degree. Another parameter was that it's clear for us, why now? Okay, that was why us, but why now? Why now is the time? is this field is really ready for disruption?
Yep. Yes.
And so on and so forth. And at the moment we landed on clinical trials, it really checked all the boxes. Major potential impact, positive on society, experimentation. We felt experts in experimental design and execution. Now is the time, post-COVID, precision medicine era, a lot of room for innovation from regulators. We see tons of leniency from regulators, from the FDA, the EMA, and other agencies. Field went through the digitization, right? Operational aspect really went through revolution.
Do you think also COVID had something to do with the sort of acceptability for new processes with regard to clinical development?
Definitely. And I think also the appetite and willingness. It's one thing to talk about things. It's another thing to write guidance. But whenever you see a successful example, you say, okay, now I want to follow. People are looking, no one wants to be the first.
Yeah.
People are talking about innovation, but actually no one wants to be the first. It's better to be the third, right? Already established, but still new. So anyway, they think COVID will accelerate.
So you had your weekly meetings, you had parameters that you set for yourself, and then you came up with we're going for clinical trials. And then within the clinical trials, you then had to also then say, okay, clinical trials is massive, right? They go for years and years. And then you had to, when did you start speaking to people in the industry to get an idea, all of that sort of
thing? Yeah. So the first thing we did is to actually thoroughly trying to read and listen to every piece of material. Actually, this is a very challenging task these days. The amount of information that you can find is
massive. When was this? What year was this?
So,
was it before ChatGPT?
Slightly before. Okay. So 2022.
So you didn't have any help from ChatGPT to do this?
Not yet. But actually, we like to read papers. We like to listen to podcasts, to scientific talks. So we're like consuming massive amounts of information.
Amazing.
And then after we felt, and obviously we spend a lot of time talking, I think that choosing the right co-founder is about choosing someone that you really feel that you're learning something new every time that you speak with him. Yes. It's definitely the case for me. Hopefully it's the case also for Elad. But once you have that, so you have the data or the papers and talks, and then we started approaching people in the industry. Actually, it wasn't that easy. When you're talking about clinical trials, it sounds loud space. But if you start breaking it down into pieces, so adaptive trials, we are focusing on adaptive trials, it's not that big of a space. And if you're talking about design of adaptive trials, already smaller space. So if you're looking for experts, you're not lefting out with...
How did you find them?
So we're looking for people who participated in conferences and gave talks, people who wrote papers.
Okay. And then, so you found the name, you just approached them on LinkedIn, you found the connection, just break it down.
So some of them we will just call the approach, and you're going to be surprised, actually, you specifically or not, but I think some of the audience is going to be surprised. People are really willing to talk about their field. They're super excited. If you are really interested to learn, people are really eager to tell you. And this is enjoyable, right? Having those conversations, really talking with one of the top experts about the field.
That is a great insight, right? To founders out there, don't be afraid to pick up the phone figuratively, probably a LinkedIn message or something else. If you're speaking about, I have this experience too, when I speak about when I was in doing different startups in orthopedics and go and speak about it, they really want to tell you, right? They like, it plays to their ego a little bit in a nice way, not in a bad way, that they feel like they can teach you something.
Yeah, for them, they are preachers, right? They truly believe, let's take adaptive trials as an example.
Yep.
Those that conducted adaptive trials really believe that this has the capabilities and the ability to transform the industry. And for them, when I'm approaching them and telling them, listen, I want to bring technology to the space and to increase the adoption of adaptive trust, you can see the smile on their face. For them, great, those tech geeks are coming to help me to change the world. Of course, I want to share with them information. I want them to be successful. I want to be part of their journey. Okay, so definitely this is one example. I wouldn't tell you that from time to time we got calls that people told us, you are crazy, it's not going to work, it's going to take ages. That's fine. Definitely one of the skills that you need to have is,
If that doesn't happen, you're not doing something right. If you're not ruffling someone's feathers, you're not disrupting.
But definitely we used a lot on network and asking for connections and not shying away from asking for favor. So yes, that's definitely helped a lot. And then it's a network, right? You're talking to someone and at the end of every call, we're finishing the call with, obviously, it's great. This is the next steps. But can you think about one or two additional people that we should talk to? And then you are already being connected from expert to expert, right?
So that's then a great tip as well. Like, you're always pitching as a startup founder, right? You always have to think about what do you need from the person. And sometimes you're raising money, sometimes you need to, but a lot of the time, just a good referral could make a huge difference. So just don't forget, hey, do you have one or two? That's a great tip. Do you have one or two other experts we could speak to? Good tip.
Yeah. Or for example, what should we read? What should we notice? Even focusing us out of this massive amount of data, what is really the theory and the practice, right? As a beginner in a field, it's not clear what is just retailing publication out there no one is using and what is really the common practice in the industry. It's really straightforward to identify, but other pieces is important to ask experts. And I think then what we started to do, again, to try to move quickly and start building things, demos, concepts, playing with data and doing back and forth, I think it's extremely helpful not to wait to have like full, crisp, highly designed, articulated idea before you're building something. If you have a good idea of what is the challenge, what you are trying to build, start
the
building.
The general direction. Yeah,
exactly.
Start building. Get out there. Get some product in the hand of your customers. Get feedback and iterate.
Exactly.
Excellent. Listen, we're coming up the time. Just quickly, a little bit about the company status. You've raised a Series seed. What have you raised and what does the trajectory look like for you guys from here?
So we raised $15 million. It was something between seed and A. And we are super excited, first and foremost, about the technology and the value that we are already bringing to sponsors out there, but especially for patients. I think the examples that I shared, again, in ALS, lupus, and oncology, at the end of the process, they are patients. So we've made a lot of progress. We have two platforms. We have the prospective platform, the retrospective platform. We have quite long runway because we have revenues and we are working with sponsors, big pharma companies, biotech CROs. And as I was saying, we are establishing the technological foundations, patents, papers, presentation, and scientific conferences. And we are trying to grow the business. We are looking for more clients and not looking to raise money in the near future, but as I was being taught.
Are you growing?
So we are headquartered in Boston. We have the R&D sites in Tel Aviv and Europe. We are slowly growing the team. We're a multidisciplinary team, so software engineers, machine learning engineers, data scientists, but also physicians and biologists. We are really trying to take the multidisciplinary approach. We are growing the business team in Boston. But we are really trying to grow the team slowly, not because we don't have money in the bank, because we truly believe that the complexity is growing exponentially every team member that is joining. And obviously, it's important to grow the team, but you need to do it very carefully.
Listen, I wish I could talk more about that because there's so many aspects to that, right? There's also like culture. What's your culture of your organization? Are you hiring the right people, not just for their skill set, but will they fit in with the company culture?
Culture, yeah. super important topic.
Maybe just a couple of minutes on that. Have you, without going into details, is there something that you talk about, you and your co-founder?
All the time. I'll share one debate. Should we hire fast or not? And not only on the number of employees that we are hiring, how much time should we spend in the interview process? And what is the level of confidence that we need to have before we are hiring someone? It's not a clear cut, right? I'll present two sides. On one hand, let's take an example of a business person. If you are hiring someone on the business team, if it's someone good, okay, one might argue that if he's not great, he or she are not great, it's a waste of time. It's not going to be enough. Let's wait for a great. Let's assume that we can measure what's the difference between good and great. But on the other hand, it's going to take time. It's going to take 3 more months, 6 more months. And doing this few months, you are bringing less business because mm-hmm. this good candidate could potentially bring you more leads, convert more leads into clients, grow existing clients. So you're losing business. So what's the right trade-off? What's the delicate balance between hiring good versus great and the timing? And in startup, it's all about time, right? Mm. This is the most precious resource that we have. And this is an ongoing debate. And we are trying to keep this debate because there's no right and wrong. It's per role, per candidate, per status of the company. But I do think that holding these two sides all the time and having an open dialogue, this is the way to go. We are not always making the right decisions, but we are trying to make informed and collaborative decisions given the data that is available. And we are trying to be adaptive, right? We are an adaptive company.
That's right.
We are trying to, yeah.
Part of the culture. Raviv, this has been a great pleasure to speak to you. Thank you for joining us on the AWS Healthcare Innovation Podcast. And good luck. I'd love to check in again, maybe sometime in a future episode, see how you're doing.
Thank you so much. It was great talking to you.
Thanks for joining us today for the AWS Health Innovation Podcast. If you want to get in touch with AWS, please check out our show notes where you can find a link. If you enjoy the podcast, the best way to support us is to share it with your colleagues and friends. We also really appreciate your reviews and ratings wherever you listen to podcasts. We love hearing feedback from our listeners, so please don't hesitate to get in touch. Again, you'll find all the details in our show notes. See you next week.